You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super-duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky tunes.
All right, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, finger on the pulse, Terry Diabolic. We got a little music playing out. Never done this before. How do you like it?
It's fine.
It's fine.
There it is.
There you go.
It's really, it took a lot of concentration.
I think you're being the other microphone, right?
Yeah, I'm right here.
There you go. So, hey, never forget.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Just want to say shout out to our dad.
Yeah, hey, Dad. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening live. We're looking to hang out in Switzerland with you.
We're going to Switzerland?
Yeah, we're going to Switzerland this month. So we're doing a little bit different today. We have taken a week off from our music part of the show to speak with Lauren Dean, one of my. I don't think we've actually worked together. I think we've worked alongside each other.
Chairs back to back.
Back to back.
Yeah, working with you is not on her resume.
No, it's not. But
phew.
But for those who don't know, Lauren Dean is a multiple Emmy Award and James Beard Award winner for producing television and directing television. You're a best-selling author, trained chef, working mom, cookbook author. What else? Do you sail?
Not well. I don't sing. I was kicked out of chorus in first grade, so don't expect any musicality.
Any sports?
Sports. Swim, yoga. You know,
yoga.
But no trophies.
No trophies.
Underachiever.
Lauren, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks. I'm glad I'm here.
It's really nice to have you here.
So
let's start at the beginning.
You want to start at the beginning?
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
Well, let's frame it this way. You have an incredible career, and easily one of these paths would have been fine, but there's multiple successes and multiple paths. So let's go to 18.
I have basically exceeded everyone's expectations of myself included. I was pretty much not geared to do anything. Later on, I read novels. That's basically what I did.
In high school,
yeah.
What did you read?
What did I read? I read, what did I see? I'm going to really date myself. I saw everything from we would sneak in to CBGB's and the Mud Club and go to Danceteria.
You went to Danceteria?
I did. That's how when I did the show with Debbie Mazur, I'm like, I knew you from the elevator. You threw me out. It was very exciting.
Oh, my God.
When we did her cooking show last year. But anyway, so no, really, basically, I just wanted to be a writer. So I went to NYU's publishing program later. And tried to get a job in magazines. But really, I just read. And I cooked. I read cookbooks as novels. I was a total geek in that sense. My mom had every cookbook. I read, like, Paula Wolfert's Morocco book, you know, and at the same time I was reading, like, Sheltering Sky. And then my dad would cook. He's the kind who could do anything, like make, take an onion and breadcrumbs and make a great meal. And my mom would do every back page of the New York Times.
Right.
And we'd visit Dean and DeLuca like it was a gallery in the 70s, you know, late 70s.
Did you find it was easier to be up on all the cookbooks when you're in high school versus now, where it's like...
No. Now I'm like embarrassed because I was, you know, in high school, I had all my mom's, you know, foodie cookbooks and I could keep up. And then later when I went to cooking school in like 91, I'm jumping ahead, but I never do a straight line. But I could go to Kitchen Arts in the, you know, early 90s. And hang out with Knock and like buy everything, you know, save my money and pretty much keep up. And now it's ridiculous.
I know that
it's good, but it's
Darren.
Hard.
Darren has just a shelf and a half of cookbooks that, you know, you leaf through. You know, maybe I'll pull three out to get a combo of something, but after that, it's like I'm not going to go through all 10 of these.
I wouldn't even call it a collection. It's just like a scattering.
No, I have like 50 boxes in a warehouse because I used to collect. I used to go up to the Berkshires and just buy old cookbooks and hunt for good things. And the cookbooks I did on Foodography, which is the show I EP'd on the set, those are all my cookbooks from my house. I was happy to get them out.
So that's later in life.
Those cookbooks came in handy.
The LD cookbook library.
Yeah, what's the most treasured cookbook you have? What's the rarest one?
The rarest, I wouldn't. I probably have like the Savoy cocktail cookbook. I think like a first edition signed or something like that I bought for $5. But I love the old Paula Wolfert's, Richard Olney. When I was in cooking school, I worked with Betty Fussell. My first job was testing her corn book, so I liked a lot of the anthropology cultural history books. And then, I mean, honestly, I kind of cooked out of the silver palate growing up. You know, like that's kind of what taught me. I was a caterer that too. And everyone says Julia, but it was too much for me. Julia.
Joy Cooking.
Joy Cooking, yes. Classic style. Classic, yes. That was like how to get a boyfriend and make dinner.
Is that what that is? Actually,
I lived in Spain and we made beef bourguignon and we scared away some guys, but I cooked that.
I actually made Julia's cream and potato leek soup last night for the first time, which is like super basic, but I was like, oh, I've never made this. It's delicious.
It's amazing. In cooking school, later, I cooked my way through all of that. But younger, it was a little more. My mom was super trendy, so I cooked out of what was kind of happening.
What was like the most trendy thing you cooked that doesn't translate?
There's a lot of bad stuff. Lots of like those fruity, duck fruity sauces with chocolate smeared on the plate and lots of dots and ugly, fussy.
Awesome. I feel like cooking in the 80s in like Wall Street was disgusting.
You know, I was really poor. I lived in the East Village in the mid 80s, you know, in a kind of dodgy block. And we would, you know, I would save up to go out for one trendy meal. And I can't remember the name of it. There was like some Japanese fusion restaurant where they came and my boyfriend, we'd saved all of our money. And there were three things on a plate that looked beautiful and didn't taste like much. And then we had to go out and it was traumatic.
Oh,
I didn't go out a lot. I couldn't afford the 80s.
Yeah. So during the 80s, so you're in cooking school? Or
no,
you were
no.
Doing
so okay, my publishing. So I know you. Yes, I worked in magazines.
Any notable ones that we may have heard of?
So I hope my children don't listen to this part. My first job, I was an editor at Penthouse Magazine. I really wanted to work in publishing. I had to support myself. It was the highest paying offer of $15,000 a year.
Wow.
And I had to support myself. And it was the best job, though. I was the fiction editor. Actually, you know what? There were restaurants involved. I got to take out Michael Korda, who was head of Simon & Schuster, and Alan Dershowitz. I was all of their editors, and I would take them to the Four Seasons when I was 20-something, and I didn't know what I was doing. It was kind of ridiculous. And then I was also the fashion editor. But I did also, my one claim to fame.
What does fashion for a penthouse look like?
They had clothing line. We would shoot in Bobby, in Mr. G Senior's house. But I also was Al Goldstein's editor. So there you go. Yeah. From Screw Magazine.
I know that you said fiction, but I'm pretty sure all those stories are real.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No one can believe them. It's true.
So how long were you there for?
I lasted about a year. It was definitely like the clubby 80s when it was a great job. You'd come in at 10, people would be pouring whiskey in their coffee, you'd do some editing. I got to buy first serial rights on novels like D.M. Thomas. I mean, I had part of the job was really good. It was a very schizophrenic job. And then we'd go out for long drunken lunches, and then you'd come back and you'd leave at 3 to go to the clubs. And after a year, I thought I would be dead, so I moved to Spain.
I'm sorry, 3 p.m. to go to the clubs?
Well, get ready and sleep so that you could stay out. That's back in the old school days.
That still happen?
Not in my life. I have 2 kids.
I don't know any. I just know people that just go to work at like 10 and just stay up. They work all the way till they go out.
I miss those days. I work, you know, like I work from what, 7 to, you know, whatever, 7, come home, take care of the kids, get back on the computer from 10 to 1. That's my life.
I mean, it doesn't stop. So you're in Spain. So you go to Spain.
I live in Spain. That's where I cooked out of the joy of cooking on a date. And that's really when, you know, I kind of saw how you could, you know, New York, then things were expensive. I make jokes about Dean DeLuca as a museum, but, you know, you'd save your money by one thing. When I lived in Madrid, you could just shop. And that's how I learned how to shop. It's a lot of like all of the, you know, kind of movements now to have small grocers and good quality food and understand artisanal food. You know, I had been a Francophile and I went to Spain just because my best friend had a job there and I thought I'd be Xerox girl. And I wound up teaching English. But basically, I cooked the whole time I was there and shopped. And that's where I kind of understood food. And that's when I decided I kind of wanted to work in food.
Yeah, I mean, I think it took a while for Spain to catch on. But I mean, definitely the last, up until it's, you know, Noma took over number one. I think Spanish cuisine was definitely the culture to look to in the last decade.
Yeah,
or so.
I mean, I was there pre-Ferran craziness. It was kind of much more rustic.
No, but
yeah, oh, no. Then it was funny because when I lived there, it was, you know, it was very traditional. And then it became, you know, one of my good friends is Anya von Bremsen, mm-hmm. who was, you know, big, wrote a great Spanish cookbook. And I would start to meet all these Spaniards later and see what was going on.
It's amazing how long it took for any other type of cuisine to really catch up to and even overtake French or Italian.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
now it's just like, I think that's part of why you see Noma at the top, because it's like, this is the new cuisine. Mm-hmm. Like Spanish is already sort of past its.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to see tapas become such a big part of American life. When I first moved here, we were actually going to open like a tortilla bar called I Tortilla. Like today we have tortilla because it was the best drunk food, you know, next to clubs like pizza shops and serve it like pizza. Didn't happen.
So you leave Spain.
Oh, I leave Spain. I come back. I work as a PA on Harry Met Sally. I get through total nepotism.
Were you at Cat's Restaurant for the famous scene?
Yes, I was, actually.
Where were you during said scene?
I was inside for a little bit, and then I had to leave. But it was one of the good scenes. I was there for a couple of good scenes. My cousin, Barry Sonnenfeld, was a DP and totally hooked me up and got me a great job. Barry Sonnenfeld. You might have heard of him. Anyway, but I actually threw away my great film career because I really wanted to cook. I was supposed to be a script supervisor on Miller's Crossing, and every film person that I was friends with stopped talking to me because I moved to New Orleans, and all I did was cook, and I quit the film and came back and went to cooking school in New York.
Where'd you go to school?
Peter Kump, when it was upstairs on East 90s, old version.
Oh, my God.
Now it's Ice, chic and fancy.
It is. I took a class at Ice. It's fun.
Yeah. No, Peter Kump was like an old brownstone upstairs, but I had Jim Peterson was my teacher and Nick Malgieri, and I was very lucky. You know, I just took it at night and worked at a theater design shop during the day to pay for it.
So before we take a musical break, what was your watershed moment? What was the, like, I'm giving it all up, I'm changing careers?
You know, when I was tripping over cables on a film set, which is very funny because as an EP now, I still sometimes trip over film cables, people will tell you. But I had no passion for it. I mean, I'm a cinephile. I love being on movies. The scale of it was too big. It's kind of a joke. I went up on one of the best films ever, and really I wanted to go down the street and eat jambalaya and know how it was made. So that's what I did.
Awesome. All right, so we're going to take a quick little musical interlude. We're talking to Lauren Dean, food luminary. Can we say that?
I don't know. I think you're overselling me.
It's a comedy thing. So we're going to play a quick song from Goyote. I can't pronounce it.
I don't even know what you're talking
about. Somebody I used to know. Great video.
Spell it so people know.
Goyte. His new album's coming out on the 19th.
Yeah? Goyte?
Goyte? It could be Goyte. I don't know. Yeah, I guess.
Probably not. Yeah, I hope not either.
All right, so we'll be right back. Here we go.
So happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me, but felt so lonely in your company. But that was love and to make us still remember.
Let it fade out.
Just let it fade.
Just let it fade. You're listening to Snacking Tunes. We are your hosts, Finger on the Pulse. We have Miss LD. Can we say that?
Yeah, I'm actually called LD a lot.
Okay, we got LD in the studio.
Because you have to know there's Lauren Thompson. There's an LT.
Yeah.
Who's also in the food world.
And there's Larry David, who is called LD.
Oh, thanks for that. Yeah.
What? You don't like the comparisons?
Yeah, Lauren? Well, I have the same slight neurotic behavior, but I think mine's more in check.
So while, as always, we get into like a good topic of conversation when the music is playing. So I wanted to just bring back the element of being young in the food industry, being a woman, and essentially playing the game and navigating your way to, from, you know, someone who was on movie sets to dropped out to play in culinary school to getting to the other side where you're a coveted...
We could talk about this and during this time that we're up to now in your timeline, which is right after culinary school.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of, it actually came together. It's a good segue point, because basically after culinary school, I knew I didn't want to work in a restaurant. I thought I wanted to open up my own Dino De Luca, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't know what to do. I catered, which is really how those places make money. And I kind of hated that. And I was also interested in history. So what I basically did was stalk older women, because there weren't a lot of women my age in culinary school. I had a few girlfriends. But
this is the good stalking kind,
this
right?
This is the good stalking. Yeah, we talked about bad stalking, good stalking. I was a polite stalker. I knew my boundaries. And I stalked. Roseanne Gold was very helpful to me. Okay. And I did some recipe testing for her. I basically did a lot of recipe testing back in the day when I was still cooking. And I was lucky enough, she passed me on to Betty Fussell, and she had just done the Companion to the Amazing Corn book. And I got to go to her house in the village and spend all day with her and cook and talk. And it was awesome. I mean, just incredible. I felt so lucky. And then I took a job at Macy's Cooking School de Gustibus with Arlene Feltman, who's married to Alan Saliak from French Culinary. And I was basically a tray girl. Like, I was never a good waitress because I'm kind of clumsy, but you basically would stand next to a visiting chef and just pass the food out to all the people who came into Macy's.
So, like,
were very mean,
like,
to
bourbon,
you.
Bourbon chicken and things like that?
You know, there were good. Jeffrey Zakarian was there. There were good people there. Good chefs that came in. Bobby Flay, you know, back then, people came in. So I assisted them and I met everybody. And then from that, they either forwarded things to me and I joined everything that I could. I volunteered. I met Julia Child because I worked at a benefit at the Rainbow Room. And, you know, all I did was make breadcrumbs for 90 hours.
Can you tell what
that
story was like? What was it like meeting Julia?
She was so tall and so great. I was making foie gras croutons. I'll never forget this.
You're blushing like a 12-year-old girl.
I am. I know, because you're like, I was such a geek. And Ariane was there. It was her foie gras. And so I had to make these croutons and just keep coating them and coating them and shaking them. And she came over and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm making the croutons." And I started to talk like her, and then I had to correct myself. And so I told her, and she said, "Yo, it's so good to see young girls in here. Keep shaking your croutons." And it was like, so happy. You know, I'm at the top of the Rainbow Room. The kitchen's great. You see amazing view.
Yeah.
So that was great. So things like that really helped me. And I joined the Culinary Historians. And back then, it was really mostly like grand dame ladies or a couple of people. And that helped for a while. And then I couldn't get a job. The Food Network had just started. I'd wanted to work there. I kept trying and stalking them. It didn't work. And then randomly, one of the girls at Macy's said, "Hey, I'm food styling tomorrow at the new Food Network. Do you want to cook?" So I showed up, and then I kind of clawed my way into being the first sous chef there when they first opened 6 months ago.
So what was your role at the Food Network as a sous chef? Because for people who don't know,
right? A real sous chef. I mean, it's basically the head elf, like mise en place girl. Like when you watch a cooking show and everything's all prepped out, I was in charge of the mise and running the kitchen. I didn't do a great job running the kitchen. Head elf. Well, okay. And I always say this is like before Emeril was Emeril, because it was before all the crazy BAM.
This was the old location, right?
We were on 1994. They'd only been open like 6 months. We were on 6th Avenue and. What, 40, yeah, I don't know, 6th Street or something, and a 36th floor with gas, hideous Westinghouse stoves and GE home refrigerators. And it was amazing because it was like kind of like a, now I'm going to offend people, but it was like a BOCES TV show. You know, you had guys coming out of camera school, they were falling asleep on the jib. And I had come from fancy film sets, so I thought it was hilarious. You know, and then you had a lot of, it was run by, at that time, Reese from CNN. So it was run like a news, you know, stripped down news org. And I actually succeeded there in part because I knew how to comport myself on the set. Like, I knew how to behave on a set. I knew when to be quiet. I knew not to wear jangly bracelets like I'm wearing today and, you know, walk around and do my styling and we're doing stuff. So that's real. And the best thing about being at the Food Network then is when it was first open, they had this show called Chef du Jour. And it was basically a casting call. These poor chefs would come in and have to shoot 6 shows in one day. And they'd be terrified.
Hours?
Yeah, 6 half hours in one day. If you were on fire, I literally would crawl under. I actually had a sitcom in development over this once. I would crawl under the set, like put the fire out. I would like, you know, if things were leaking, you'd sneak hands on and sneak. If they forgot a spoon, you'd like crawl under and put a spoon on. It was hilarious because you couldn't stop. It was shot live to tape as if it was a news show. So these poor chefs would come in. And they'd be tugging on their, you know, their fancy chef coats, the Brigard coats. And for once, the power was inverted after working for a lot of these, like, some difficult French chefs that I had staged or volunteered at. When they got out there, they were suddenly really vulnerable. back then, nobody took media training and knew what to do. No, so right. It was awesome because basically I had a good story mind and I would be able to say to them, no, you should say this, you should say this. Cause, and then I realized what I really cared about was the stories behind the food, not cooking the food. And that's really when I switched to producing because I would tell, I'm trying to remember who it was from Provence, great Antoine, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't remember, but all these great chefs that came from all over the country, John Ash from Fetzer, you know, just amazing, Roger Verger, I'm making his, he's, they were training us too, because we were mostly not the top
that's
of the line
I mean, you're
cooks.
Talking like high-end,
no,
super
Hubert, you know, Hubert Keller, from all over, he taught me how to saddle a lamb, because I didn't know, I had only been out of cooking school like a year and a half or something like that, so I was getting educated how to cook the food, and then when Emeril was there, and then later Mario, I did Mario's first mise en place, his first day, you know, and he stuck his famous story of sticking his hand bleeding in the tomato sauce to hide the blood. So
no, hold on. No.
He tells that one.
What is
the
story?
When Mario cut himself the first day and he stuck his hand in the tomato sauce to hide the blood that was like coming out because we never stopped the cameras. It was great.
Shock. You can't see it. So I want to talk to you about anyway. Something that you just said about the storytelling behind the cooking shows.
Yes.
People, and I, the way when I do television, I approach it the same way. I think whether even it's a studio show or Verite, there's a story.
Yes.
And I learned that, though, from watching shows that you had done and, like, thanks. Naked Chef and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me what that was like when you started pitching to people to get away from this very raw, live news thing, saying, like, there are stories to be told here.
Well, I mean, there's Dump and Stir, which is let's learn a recipe. And, you know, that's great.
Which is such a mean name for such complicated things.
I know. But really, I don't want to tell you how many hours of Dump and Stir. And I love them and I still do them. But because you want to know how to cook.
Yeah. And you learn a lot from them. The most cooking I ever learned from is on the Dump and Stir shows.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I think I try to do these hybrids. I mean, that was when I was at Martha.
Yeah.
Basically, I was Bobby's producer for a while, and then I went to Martha Stewart for many years. And that was where, you know, you were able to both tell a story and do Dump and Stir. And if you were lucky, fuse them all with a frontal, you know, front field piece. Every recipe, and I think this is much more common now in cookbooks and television shows than it was, you know, 10, 12 years ago when it was instructional cooking. Now, like when I do our foodography, we call it sort of a beautiful narrative doc style where we'll incorporate, we don't expect you to be able to make the recipe from watching, but if you're a cook, you should be able to understand enough of the food steps. And then we tell the story in some voiceover and in, you know, shot to support the history of the food.
At what point were you able to make that shift from the story, from just being like, you need to be able to watch this and make it, to being like, this is more about the overall story and it might not be for everyone to cook at home?
As, you know, I can make all the jokes in the world about the Food Network and, you know, being on fire and still taping, but if people hadn't grown up watching that, and if there hadn't been such a huge space to show so many different people cooking, you never would have gotten those shows on the air. So back then, there were some narratives shows. There was a news show. There were different things that you could do. But the more popular the channel became, the more risks you could take, and you kind of educated your public as you went along. And you went from beyond PBS, you know, which was the only other place that was sort of doing travelogue.
Right.
So you kind of, if you look at it, you want to break it down. You had your travelogue, and then you have your Dump and Stir, and then some of them got fused. You
right.
know, Tony Bourdain, of course, masterful person.
Yeah, but he doesn't really do Dump and Stir.
No, but the other people are maybe not Dump and Stir, but they're kind of showing you the recipe, and he's narrating through it. That's a more sophisticated
version. Yeah. What was Bobby Taste of America or?
When he did his. Yeah, he went across the nation. I think I was having kids during those years. I don't remember writing cookbooks. But he went to Taste the Nation. Those were still like travel shows where then the people at the restaurant in their homes were sharing their recipes.
Sort of the
bridge.
Eric is really probably one of the better examples now, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
he's good.
Mm-hmm. He's great. I mean, there's a lot of good people.
So what was one of the first shows that you really put your stamp on?
What my first? Well, the way I became a producer is I went out to Fetzer to shoot something with Curtis Akins, who was a grocer, and I wound up like writing the recipes while I was there at night, and then buying the food and buying the props and putting everything together and talking to him. But that was my first stamp was when we did a kind of a housewifey show over at Lifetime called The Main Ingredient with Bobby. He had been at the Food Network, and I brought him over there. This is around 96. But it was still like a studio show for Lifetime. It was really when I went to Martha that there's clearly an archetype at Martha where things are done the Martha way. But
right.
you were allowed to suggest stories, come up with stories, mm-hmm. create stories. I went to New Orleans and we shot beautiful hours with some obscure people that we found, home cooks, one of her friends who has a culinary antique shop, Patrick Dunn, Lucullus, wonderful. So lots of things like that. And then my own, I mean, I think Foodography is that I'm doing now is the show that I've wanted to do my whole life, which is kind of fusing history, the present, the story behind the food through a historical perspective with Morocco, who is hilariously funny, you know, which I like to try to be funny and not take this all, you know, so seriously.
We're not going to let you skip 15 years, though.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah, there's a whole...
Like, I must be... Is anyone still awake out there?
Yeah, this is really good. Okay. So we are going to play another song, and then we'll come back. See, we've got keys jangling, phones ringing. We're going to come back. We're going to quickly move through the last...
Oh my God, I'm 110.
Decade and a half. No, you're just very accomplished. And then we're going to talk about, and this for you to think about, what got easier and what still is just as hard as when you were starting out.
Okay, I have my homework.
Yeah, you have your homework to do. You're listening to Snacky Tunes. We're your host, Finger on the Pulse. Once again, shout out to our dad who's listening live today, which I think is one of the first times ever. So we're really excited.
Hi, Dad.
And
nice boys you have.
Oh, thank you. Actually, the show we were watching on CNBC was like, they said for the thing that they really wanted was praise. And if their bosses could send a letter to their parents and their grandparents for letting them how good they did. And I was like, I don't think that probably happened.
Well, here's a guess. They're great, Dad.
Yeah, thanks. All right. Who is that? Well, he'll tell us when he sits down. You're listening to Snacky Tunes. We're your host, Finger on the Pulse. Who was that?
That was Cascade featuring Mindy Gledhill called Eyes Excitemix. You can thank Alan Astor turning me out to that.
It's a good track. So, 95 to 2011.
Oh, my God.
No, I'm just kidding. So, why don't you just, I mean.
No, look.
No, hold a second. We'll just say cookbooks.
Okay, let's pick up.
Okay.
Let's say cookbooks.
Let's say cookbooks. Because so you're making your bones as a producer.
Yes.
You're doing the thing that all producers do, which is sort of like produce from show to show.
Yeah. But at that point, I had been at Martha like for a long time, Martha, for like
but,
5 years.
But then
years,
you then you did something that a lot of people either don't do or don't think to, is you start to diversify your brand and make yourself, beyond just like a day player or like a show to show player, you start to make yourself like your own person.
Well, I mean, that sounds like I had a plan, which all of this sounds like I have a plan. I just always really tried to do interesting things, and it seems like now my career had a path. But I had been working for Martha, you know, up until 2001, and I had my son. I was living in LA for a little bit in Santa Monica, and we moved back to New York, and I was producing, but I was sort of fried. You know, I'd been working forever, it felt like, and now I had a baby. So I really just wanted to, we bought a house in the woods, and I thought I'd just write cookbooks, which if you know me, the house in the woods part was a very big mistake.
Yeah.
I like a house in the woods, but at that point, to be alone with a baby in a house in the woods and write a cookbook was tricky for me, because I was still producing, actually. So it was a lot of commuting and writing. But basically, I had this idea for how your life changes when you have a kid, which right now is sort of current. When I did the book in, oh my gosh, I really should know when my book was written. I guess my book was written maybe 2004. I'm really bad about dates. Kitchen Playdates and Chronicle Books published it, which was great because they did a really beautiful job. And the book was really written out. Originally, it was going to be chefs cook for their kids, and it wasn't going to be written by me. It was just going to be like a compendium of me talking to all the chefs I knew and how they cook for kids, because we were all having kids. But really, what I realized, it was more of like an entertaining book, and I'd made it my recipes, a couple from like Bobby or other people that I had good relationships with. But how to entertain when your friends came over, you left half the cooking because you never finished, so don't feel guilty. And it was very Martha-like. It had lots of projects like spice paintings with your little kids and then spice recipes to match. It was very kind of formulaic.
Very cute.
It was very cute, and I was very sincere about it at the time. Now I look at it like, oh my God, I tortured all these poor women at home with their kids who didn't have training, you know. But the recipes still hold up, and they're beautiful pictures, Tina Rook. Rupp took of my kids, so I did that, and it was great, and I was
the nicest scrap memory book.
Exactly, right. It was very indulgent, but no, it did well. Do you know that is the funniest thing about that book is it wound up in MoMA, which is like the most random thing of all in the bookstore.
Oh,
that was
the
proudest thing. If you had to say what I was the most proudest of, having a book in MoMA.
I have to say that I think as being a New Yorker, getting your name or your artwork or anything like that in like certain New York institutions, yeah, like the MoMA or the New Yorker.
Oh, it was an anthropology, which I thought was super cool.
Or something like that. Like, those are like the small. It's those small victories. It's like, oh, did you see my piece in Central Park?
It didn't sell well, but it was critically acclaimed. Oh, no, but I loved it. And so.
Critically write your own review.
I'm kidding.
LD says best cookbook.
Best cookbook ever. No. Well, it was a passion project, and now, it was a snapshot of my life at the time, which I'm glad for I had. But then after that, I went 360. Then I had to get a job again because that wasn't working.
Right.
And as I was doing that, I did the first reality cooking show. Actually, I'd like some credit for that.
Which
I
was?
Think, which was not my idea, but I got called to do it. Dweezil and Lisa. A lot of people will.
Was that the
out.
First reality?
It was one of them. Name one before, really. Because Kathleen Finch, who now runs HGTV, was at the Food Network and called up CBS News Productions.
Well, what was the again? Show? They cooked together?
Dweezil and Lisa. Dweezil Zappa, Lisa Loeb were dating, and they wanted to learn how to cook. So. We put them, Broadway Video hired me, my good friend David Lang, rescued me from who knows what, but put me out there and sent me, it was very funny, I was supposed to just be working from New York because I had two kids under two, so that was a little later. It was actually before the book, but I can't keep my chronology straight. But I had two kids under two, I wasn't supposed to be traveling, and I wound up going on the road with Lisa and Dweezil and my six-month-old daughter that I was still nursing.
You brought her with you?
I had to. I was nursing. I was very into that. And I was
quiet on set? I mean, was that
Yeah, I would be concerts at night. I had a babysitter with me. My ex-mother-in-law used to come with me. Yeah, it was a little crazy, but I only took her on 3 trips. I wasn't like on the road, but they
it's not really on the road.
It was kind of on the road, but not on the road. I wasn't in a van and a bus with them all, but so we did that, and they wanted to know about food, and I found great people like Scott Conan when he had first started, lots of good people came.
That's awesome.
And I cooked and I went to the house, to the Zappa house, and the mom cooked and yelled at me. You know, it was good. It's great. I get yelled at a lot, but I have a thick skin. You have to have a thick skin to be a producer. Note to self or note to viewers, listeners.
Can you give a little insight to people about what it's like to produce food television specifically and the difficulties or the challenges that come with that type of genre of food?
It's kind of sitcom-ish because, let's face it, it's not brain surgery. I'm not saving anyone's lives. So in the reality of like what goes on in the world, it's a luxury to be able to have a great job like this. You know, I get that completely. Then when you're dealing with lots of money, lots of time pressures, and people say, you know, don't work with like children or animals or food, you know, it's kind of like you're putting them all together because right. you have talent that can be difficult or erratic or drunk or unhappy or, you know, great and happy. And you have food that has to kind of do its thing. And yeah. the people that are making it, it's, you know, I have a lot of artists. Like somebody, my line producer at CBS said to me the other day, he's like, you're very good with crazy artistic temperamental people. And I said, yeah, I like them. And you have to know how to manage them. You have to have a good editor later to make everything look yep. great. You have to have, it's collaboration, which is why I love producing. It's not all about me.
So, I mean, this leads into, you know, the homework question that we gave you because, you know, we're younger and we still are facing, well, I mean, we're still
thanks
facing,
a lot.
Well, no, I'm saying like you have a career
no,
that,
I am
that,
old
we,
school,
that we,
as I always said, that's how Darren and I met. I said, yeah. oh, I'll tell you about food.
No, it's true. Because I was definitely coming up. I mean, you met me during my throwdown.
Was it like
you're still coming up. I've been out of college for 6 years.
No. But I'm saying,
but
I'm saying you met me. You really
back
met,
in the day.
You met me really at like the start of my New York career when I was just like
right.
No, because that was the first time. I mean, I was working with Bobby, and I was like, yeah. oh my god, this is the biggest chef in the world. I'm on his show. It was a learning, it's a learning curve.
Yeah.
So my question is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm. But
Greg, I forget.
No, I'm just saying because I'm sure your experience is. It's good, but
it's not about me.
It's not anymore. Anyway, so my question is like there were when you were starting out in like the first 5 to 10 years versus where mm-hmm. you are now. It's like, what did you think would change and get easier, and what has just remained consistently a struggle, and what has actually gotten easier?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what's gotten easier in one way is that there's, a lot more opportunities, there are more channels, there are more shows, there's more interesting people, there's more interesting food things going on, frankly, to cover. At the same time, there's a lot more competition. I mean, when I, made my career, I didn't set out to be a culinary television producer. There were three people who did that. One worked at, GMA. The morning shows had somebody who did that, and then there was PBS. People didn't really, and there was Charlie Pinsky and Jeff Drummond who worked with Julia. That was, there weren't that many people doing this, and it wasn't really a plan.
That's no one.
Now.
Competition on one hand is not competition.
No. But I mean, now, I get tons of emails and tons of calls like, how can I do this? And I try to meet with everyone and help them. And yeah. I've hired a lot of people who are good stalkers, as we say, like politely persistent and not creepy or torturing you. But what's
By the hard, way, a note to the stalkers, yeah. and I still go through this too, but just because they don't get back to you in a month doesn't mean that they're not interested.
That's true. Right. It's true. And, I always find someone and I keep them. I don't have anything, I didn't have anything last month. I have something kind of now. But,
I've written you for things in past.
You are. And I try to help and I pass you on to other people. I mean, I'm a big, pass and forward kind of person. But so what's hard now is the competitive is that, there's so many shows shooting. It's hard to find. Well, people are so jaded. When I used to call people to be on the show, they were thrilled. Now they're like, well, how are you going to pay me? Or I don't feel like it. Or, right. which is still kind of surprising to me sometimes. And there's a lot of competition to get a story now where it wasn't as hard to do that for certain shows.
And
personally,
as the producer?
What's hard for me? I have been freelance since I left Martha for 9.5 years. And I'm waiting for Foodography to be picked up. Bruce Seidel, if you're listening, just for another season. Hi, Bruce. I'm doing a pilot with Mo now, which I'll tell you about. And I have another project, but I don't have a job after September 20th, which is kind of a crazy way to live when you're, like a single mom with two kids. So that's the biggest challenge.
But I mean, you've consistently found work for yes. a number of years. And so
no, I've never had to
It's about
right. No, but I'm saying, like, does that not, does that still, like, creep up in the back of your mind, or just, like, something will come up?
Yeah, no, I'm completely, I'm a neurotic New Yorker, but I, you know, I still make all my calls, but I still, my friends don't want to hear it. I don't know what I'm doing next week. They're like, you can write a, you know, you can do something.
I think
you could start that millionth cookbook, or.
I co-authored the meatball cookbook. Oh, yeah. Guys, the meatball shop
guys.
Let's talk about that.
Those guys, we love those guys. They're great. They did the barbecue with us.
Yep.
And their cookbook should be extremely interesting.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's so easy. The thing about what's brilliant about those guys is the food is so flavorful and the recipes are so easy.
How simple are their meatballs?
So simple, they don't fry them. You could not find a simpler, more delicious meatball. And I don't say that as a person.
We love. I love the Franks.
But I love the Franks. They're my neighbors.
But after and a lot of the rest, I cooked all weekend this weekend, and I made a lot of stuff from their from their cookbook. But I get to the meatballs and I'm like, this is, I like, I oh, just, this is,
they're insane. I make these after work that from the meatball shop cookbook. Like, you know, I come home from work with the kids, you can throw things together.
I made Bobby's meatballs after we did the throwdown with him. They're good too, but it's all, it's
I don't think Van's a meatball guy, but okay.
No, we did the meatball throwdown. He had whatever recipe it was.
Okay.
But, they're good.
She sounds skeptical. Bobby's gonna be mad at me. Yeah.
If Bobby's listening,
I'll put it this way, of like all the recipes that of his that I saw. That was definitely one of the, like, the easier to approach.
Okay.
One. So yes. I know we talked about it at the end of last break, but we skipped over it. So you're on your third season of Foodography.
Yes.
What is Foodography for those who've never seen it?
Foodography, I hope you get the Cooking Channel. Not everyone does. Foodography is a show about the history of a single topic of food, or we go to cities. This season we're going San Francisco aired last week. It's in reruns. Hawaii and... which is not a city, but we went to a few cities in Hawaii and Las Vegas. And then we switched to a half hour format, which I'm happy about for the other shows, because we can now shoot enough original material. So the shows are beautiful. We have the new Sony F3 cameras, and I have a great DP and director and great staff. And they're half hours. We did beer. We did Greek food. And basically it's the past, the present, the future, and the fanatics tell the history of the food and dishes. And Mo Rocca, who's hilarious and irreverent, and we do these crazy... stand-ups in all sorts of locations and all sorts of costumes. he's on like toy cowboy horses. And
what
things.
I like about Mo
rocking horses
is that he
can I call him Mo?
Of course.
Yeah.
Mo.
Is that he plays the part very well. A lot of these chefs, even the ones that are relaxed, they all just like still like want to wear like t-shirts or button-up shirts. Like Mo has a lot of fun with food.
Yeah.
He's smart.
And he's interested, and he admits what he doesn't know. He doesn't pretend that he's a foodie, you know, or a food, not, I wouldn't say foodie, but, you know, he doesn't really cook, which is the premise of his, you know, new show. We're doing the pilot.
Can I ask how he made that jump? Because I remember from The Daily Show.
He was on Iron Chef a few times. You know, he eats out, and he's got a critical mind. He's got this insane brain, which is quite intimidating. You want to say my biggest challenge as an executive producer is keeping up with Mo Rocca, who, you know, does NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me, who knows every state capital, who knows everything about everything. So no, he's just a walking, you know, Harvard genius. But I try to make him laugh and give him great stories, and it seems to be working.
Do you try and get like 3 minutes, just be like, all right, Mo, today here's a joke of the day.
I'm okay. I think he's tweeted maybe one joke of mine. He's my director.
Hey, but I'm getting there.
No, but we work on the copy, and we have him, you know, in dim sum banners in Chinatown in San Francisco. You know, some ideas get through. It's all good.
How was San Francisco?
It was amazing. We had the best time. We went to Big Sur also, Big Sur Bakery. Oh, yeah. Amazing.
Where did
beautiful.
You eat in San Francisco?
We shot all over. We did Comstock, which was outside. We did a blogger party. Oh my gosh, I should know everything. We went to Lafitte for ice cream. We went to Mission Burrito, great burritos. Mo did a great piece with the owner of that shop.
Mission Burrito? There's only two approved San Francisco burrito places.
Oh, here we go.
And El Farolito.
And Taqueria Cancun.
Mm-hmm.
So
we actually don't have enough time to get into this.
We don't.
So we want to thank you for coming on the show. And my last question. I know that you kind of answered this.
Do I not get to ask the last question?
No, I do. You get to set up the next thing.
Oh, and you have to let me. Okay.
No. We have to let you. Oh, there's a couple things. Oh, first off,
I have some business.
Let's take care of business first.
Okay, so I have a favor. Everyone who has a grandmother or grandfather who wants to have them teach Mo Rocca how to cook their treasured recipe, go to realpeoplecastingnewyorkcity.com and try to be on our pilot. Thanks. Okay.
And anything else?
No, we're just kidding.
So this
hold on. Website.
Website. It's in the middle of construction, but there's laurendean.com, and my old one is Cake Productions, my production company. But they all link, and you can.
They all link.
I think you've heard enough of me.
Go to
laurendean.com.
This has been great. So my question is, is as someone who started the movement, spit on, thrown in dumpsters,
yep,
navigate your world in a field that pretty much grew up as you grew up. What advice do you give to the people starting out, and not just like, hey, mm-hmm, in your first year? I'm talking like a 10-year, 20-year type of mindset.
Okay.
Since you obviously didn't have a plan, but like,
no, but I had some rules, I guess you should say, or guidelines. Rules are, you need to be nicer to people when you're asking for their help or doing your job. Everyone kind of has an attitude, and I have, I put in the work.
You might be the most bubbly guests we've had on here, and I don't mean that in anything. But it's like most of our guests don't laugh.
You guys are pretty funny. I don't know why.
That was recorded by an independent third party. I'm going to just play that for everyone.
So be nice.
I'll be nice. No, be nice. Do the work. Read. I not as much now because I'm busy and, I have a lot going on. But I read everything. And now there's so much more to keep up with blogs and Eat Out and talk to people and join things and don't have an attitude and, connect with. I think everybody's way more connected now. So that part's easier. I was very isolated when I was doing the food thing. And now it's so communal that it's amazing. And I think, do stuff on your own, take your money, your time, your sweat equity. And, for my cookbook, I lost a lot of money doing my book. Like, I wanted pictures in my book. Everyone said, keep the money. You have to pay for the pictures. And I didn't, I took the advance. And believe me, I've supported myself my whole career, my whole life, pretty much. So you can do that. There's no trust fund behind me doing that.
No,
working hard.
I have to say that I appreciate that, because as someone who career path is similar, right? Like, summer gets slow, and as soon as
I took all jobs. Sometimes we're talking about all my glamorous jobs. I've taken some really bad jobs.
Give one bad job.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I don't know, answering the phone in like a really snooty Upper East Side real estate firm. Being where I was yelled at. I don't know. I'm sure I had a lot of bad assistant jobs.
So, and then I do have one question. Sorry. Yeah. Don't give me the face.
I don't have any more advice.
No, this is about...
I'll do that next. Advice book.
Where do you see, or where would you like to see the future of food television?
I would like there to be enough room for people to have their shows be on the air a little longer. All the people that are big name marquee chef stars like Mario and Bobby and Emerald, they were on the air for like a year or two before they became really good and really famous. And now you have to get out there and be awesome right out of the box. And that's a tall order, So I wish that people had more time for their shows. And I wish that people would, try to do smarter shows. I have faith that people like to watch smart TV and not just watch, scripted train wreck things. Oh, I have one other thing that I wanted to talk. Oh, no.
No.
I'm just working on this fun. I wanted to shout out to my friend Amrita Sen, who's doing this great Bali doll project. She's a Bollywood singer and a cook and is creating a whole line of bags and stuff and clothing and a whole little empire that I'm working with, which is fun. That's my next little secret Indian project. By Indian music.
One more question. I know. What type of cuisine would you like to see more represented on food TV?
I feel like I'm the poster child for cooking child, but I feel like they're really doing a lot of different ethnic cuisines now. So I feel like that's been doing really well. I'm glad to see more obscure things. I'm tired of I'm not a big competition eating bugs gross out girl. So I'd like less of that and more of real people cooking and not being, after years of Martha, you don't have to be perfect. I've kind of been in recovery now. So I think it's good.
All right. Well, thank you for being on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you guys.
LD, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I will be gone next week again. But I believe this will be the last time, and I think come fall, you'll get to see or hear both of our voices and be like, which one asked that question?
I can't confirm the band yet, but it's almost 90% confirmed, but it's going to be a live performance next to you. And the Dos Toros guys.
I'm going to miss them.
Who have promised tacos.
Might need to cancel my trip.
I'm back.
All right. Well, thank you again. And
thank you, what are you taking us out with?
This is the first track off Watch the Throne, which came out this week, which if you want to read an article... I think it was Time, maybe, who did the article, or Newsweek, about how they protected the album from being leaked. It's insane.
I would like to read that.
I would like to send it to you. All right, so it's called No Church in the Wild, featuring Frank Ocean. This is Jay-Z and Kanye on Snacky Tunes. We'll be back
next week.
And thanks, Dad. Thanks for listening. See ya.
Given disguise as a feast, rolling in the Rolls Royce Caniche. Only the doctors got this, I'm hiding from police. Cocaine seats, all white like I got the whole thing bleached. Drug dealer chic, I'm wondering if a thug's prayers reach. It's pious, pious, for God loves pious. Socrates asks, whose bias do y'all seek? Off Plato, screech. I'm out here balling, I know you hear my sneaks. Jesus was a carpenter, Yeezy, lay beats. Overflow the Holy Ghost, get the hell up out your seats. Preach.
Human beings in a mob. What's a mob to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer who don't believe in anything? We make it out alive. Alright, alright. No church in the wild.
Stripe like a zebra, I call that jungle fever. You on that control, the threesome, just roll the weed up until I get me some. We formed a new religion, no sins as long as there's permission. And deception is the only felony, to never fuck nobody without telling me. Sunglasses and Advil, last night was mad real. Sun coming up 5 a.m. I wonder if they got calves still. Think about the girl in all leopard, who was rubbing the wood like Kiki Shepherd. Two tattoos, one red, no apologies. The other said love is cursed by monogamy. That's something that the pastor don't preach. That's something that a teacher can't teach. When we die, the money we can't keep, but we probably spend it all, cause the pain ain't cheap. Preach.
Human beings in a mob. What's a mob to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer who don't believe in anything? Will we make it out alive? Alright, alright. No church in the wild. No church in the wild. No church in the wild.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.
New York Night Train, Summer Soul Shindig, Rockaway Beach Party, featuring the 45 RPM soul magic of DJ Jonathan Tobin. Saturday, August 20th, 6 to 9 at Ripper's, Boardwalk 86. Free party!